Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Andy Statman's musical career, which dates back to the 1970s, has been quite varied, with forays into American roots music, R&B, jazz, and klezmer, which he has played on both stringed and reed instruments. He has appeared on over 100 recordings, and in 2012 he was awarded the NEA National Heritage Fellowship, the nation's highest honor in the traditional arts. He says Monroe Bus, his latest recording on Schieffer Records, was originally conceived to be a collection of interpretations and improvisations on the instrumentals of Bill Monroe, but it turned out to be something a lot more. And he joins me now, along with his mandolin, along with percussionist Larry Eagle. Welcome both of you to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I understand that the two of you will be performing a number of songs for us today. That's exciting.
Yeah.
It's always exciting to play.
You never know.
Andy, you've said Bill Monroe's music, quote, had a tremendous influence on me when I started out as a mandolin player and has continued to do so ever since. And there's a picture from 1966 on the cover of this CD of Bill Monroe making his way to the stage at a performance in Fincastle, Virginia. And right behind him in the background is you. 16 years old?
Yeah. My parents were very understanding. And I started playing bluegrass when I was around 11, 12. And I started playing the mandolin when I was about 15.
You were playing banjo and guitar originally?
Correct, yeah.
But not all stringed instruments are the same.
No, but prior to playing the mandolin, the guitar and the banjo, first of all, gave me an understanding of the idiom. It strengthened my fingers and sort of set it up for me to move right into mandolin playing.
Had you traveled all the way from Queens down to Virginia to see Bill Monroe when you were 16?
Yeah, to see Bill Monroe and others, but I already had been doing that in rural Pennsylvania, not that far from Philly, about 3 hours out of New York. There was a open-air country music park called Sunset Park, and they used to have all the bands, the great bluegrass bands, come there and play. So a bunch of us would go down there on Sundays, and there were also a number of bars, and I had known musicians in New Jersey where they had transplanted Southerners and they had bluegrass bands playing there.
And you could go to bars when you were underage?
They would let me in because I knew the musicians and I'd have a Coke and a hamburger or whatever and listen to the music. And, you know, I'd take the subway back from Times Square to Flushing Main Street and then get a bus. And you know, it was the whole thing.
Well, you didn't just play mandolin and not just bluegrass. Haven't musicians like Albert Eiler, Dave Tarras, and Junior Walker also been important influences?
Yeah, that was later on. I think Bill Monroe even said that bluegrass is a really wonderful training ground for musicians in terms of getting to understand style, phrasing, how to bring out a melody, variation, improvisation, tone on your instrument. Time. It's a great training ground, and many musicians who came out of bluegrass went on to play other types of music.
In your case, it's obvious you didn't want to get stuck in one style.
Yeah, you know, I'd been already there in bluegrass. A lot of bluegrass in itself is a synthesis of a lot of different styles of music that were happening around Bill Monroe as he grew up and matured. So a lot of musicians in bluegrass are always listening to Eddie Lang and Joe Venuti and Django and Stephan.
No, go ahead.
And from there I began listening to people like Monk and Bird and people like that. And I remember I heard on WBAI, actually, they played Albert Eiler live in Greenwich Village, that Vanguard record. And
my show on BAI in those days was called Round Midnight, and it was a Charlie Parker version.
Oh, that's
that was my theme.
That with Bud Powell playing that? Is that, yeah. That one? Yeah, that live one. Yeah, that's Powell is unbelievable on that. He's, you know. Yeah, so I heard this record, and I was about 16, 17, maybe a year after that, maybe 17. And, you know, a lot was going on then. I think Sgt. Pepper had just come out, and Jimi Hendrix had just come out. And, you know, at 17, you're very romantic and idealistic. And I heard this music, and I said, wow, you know, this is for me. This is what I want to do.
Well, let's get Larry Eagle in here. You also don't seem to want to get stuck with any one style. So over the years, as I understand it, you've performed with the Platters, the Drifters, the Neutrinos, John Legend, Lana Cantrell, Andy Statman, of course, and you played on Bruce Springsteen's Seeger Session CD.
I did both the original recording, and then we did a live concert in Dublin at the end of the tour.
And that's a wide range of styles. How much do you have to adapt?
I would say that every gig requires adaptation. There's every gig I play, every project requires a lot of listening and sort of processing what you need to do. And that's why I've done all that.
Do you use the same basic percussion setup no matter what the style of the music?
No, I change it up a lot. I go back sometimes. I look, there's a video of us recording the Seeger Sessions, and I see some of the instruments that I had set up for that recording, and none of us knew what we were going to be doing, so I had a real assortment of odd things, some basic drum kit items, but also at least one Middle Eastern drum designed in Colorado, and a cymbal I'd picked up in Malaysia, a real mix.
And you've brought a Middle Eastern drum here to accompany Andy, a dumbek. What is
a dumbek?
It?
Yes,
a dumbek. It kind of looks like a bongo.
I would say it looks more like it's got sort of that semi hourglass shape of a djembe, West African drum, but also it's a very standard setup for a lot of Middle Eastern music.
How much of your work with Andy has been on klezmer music?
It's hard to narrow that down because we don't consider the music to be klezmer in general, although we do approach it that way very, very occasionally. But I had done a lot of klezmer and a lot of bluegrass. I admire all the great bluegrass drummers, like none come to mind.
Andy, we want to help out. Bluegrass drummers.
Oh, bluegrass drummers. You know, there are one or two session drummers. This is going back to the early 50s, the mid 50s already. You had some snare drums on, you know, with brushes on some bluegrass sessions. And particularly the Osborne brothers, Jim and Jesse, who were a bit more country oriented, had drums. And I know back at bluegrass festivals, I know when I was in a group called Breakfast Special, we had a drummer, and some other bands started using drummers. It became pretty common. It's not as common as it once was, but I know Sam Bush has a snare drummer's band. He used to play with, Maynard Ferguson, actually. He played drums with Maynard Ferguson.
Played with Maynard, wow.
Yeah, and I was just playing snare with, but he's in Nashville. He probably does a lot of sessions.
It's just so much crossover.
Yeah.
For example, the great jazz clarinetist Don Byron has also played a lot of klezmer.
You with Hank Isnetsky in the band up there, yeah.
And I once talked to him about it. He did it originally because he was just trying to make some extra money when he was a struggling beginner, and then he fell in love with the music. So do jazz and klezmer have certain affinities?
They're really different music saying very different things. There are some similar musical conclusions, I'd say even more with R&B than certain things that Junior Walker did, klezmer clarinetist always did, using certain types of trills and high notes at certain points to reach a crescendo or to push the music further. You know, but they're really saying different. You know, each music is really saying different things. There are similarities, but they're, you know, even if they're synthesis, they're usually coming out of one or two people's original vision, and then they become a lot of people's visions. So,
Larry, what about time signatures? Klezmer ever played in the same time signatures as jazz or rock?
The time signatures don't generally change.
But you don't play 4-4.
It's actually, most klezmer is 4-4, but it can be deceptive. There's a certain rhythm or clave that is the standard feel for a lot of klezmer. We had an interesting experience a few years ago. We played we played the first Jewish wedding in the island of Rhodes since the Holocaust. And there was a Greek band that was playing at this party with us, and Greek music is famously polyrhythmic in terms of their time signatures, a lot of 7 and 5 and 9. And we got out and played a dance set, which I guess would be the closest thing to klezmer that we usually do. And afterwards, the keyboard player from the Greek band came up to me and said, "That was amazing. How do you count that?"
That was 4-4.
That was 4-4, yeah, yes.
But also, we're very free. We do a lot of improvisation. So the phrasing is if they were following the phrasing, it might throw them off. Because it's not something that they would be used to. It would owe more to maybe jazz than, I'll say I did a record for a few years. I had a band, you know, with Kenny Werner and Bob.
Kenny Werner did a live performance for us on the show. Which is
wonderful. Kenny's incredible. So we did a record called Between Heaven and Earth, which was, you know, old Hasidic material played with. Since it's modal music, I always had the idea that using a McCoy, you know, stacked fourth type of approach to the music.
McCoy Tyner, famous pianist who was with John Coltrane for many years.
We did a record, and I think it was one of the Times top 10 records of the year, and, you know, we did a bunch of concerts and touring behind that.
So, well, you've recorded and toured with a wide range. We mentioned Kenny Werner, but also The Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan, Dr. John, Ricky Skaggs, Bela Fleck, also Yitzhak Perlman, Stefan Grappelli, David Amram, among others. Have record stores had difficulty deciding which bins to put your CDs in? Bluegrass, klezmer, R&B, or jazz?
You know, I mean, back when there were record stores, I used to record the Jewish music on one label and my own music on another, and then I sort of combined everything. I mean, I think there were some difficulties, and people might think of, you know, I was, you know, in the initial sort of reinterest of klezmer music when that happened. I was part of the, you know, one of the few musicians who started that whole thing back in the early mid 70s. And so a lot of people only knew me as playing klezmer. So when they heard I played bluegrass, it freaked them out. And it's, you know, so there's always been a little confusion. But I think for the last 10 years, the trio with Larry and Jim Whitney, bass player, we've really just been playing music and not really worrying so much about boundaries, unless we feel at that moment, you know, the boundaries will enhance what we're saying.
Well, a number of the tracks on Monroe Bus, your new CD, strike me as pure bluegrass. The title song, Broadbeat's Blues, named after a musician. Statman Romp, another musician. Rawhide, Mockingbird especially. But there's also a gospel-tinged track, Reminiscence. Bluegrass gospel?
Well, there is a whole tradition of gospel quartets and bluegrass music. It's what Bill Monroe did, who was ostensibly the creator of this music, is he took the traditional Appalachian tunes, the Appalachian ballads. He took blues. There was a blues guitar player from New Orleans used to make a circuit, and where they were in Kentucky, the black and the white musicians used to work together, and there was, you know, so they would just play together, dances, whatever they did. There was no really color line in that part of So he always put a strong blues elements. In fact, he said he was very conscious in what he put in and left out. And he said that, first of all, if he didn't play bluegrass, he'd want it to have been a blues man. And he also said that since blues is so strong, he said you had to know where to draw the line. Otherwise, it would overpower everything else. But he also came out of a whole, you know, shape note singing thing as a child. And, you know, he heard all sorts of gospel music. And he had some of the best gospel music, it'll give you chills, ever recorded, I believe. And that was part of his show. He's called the Bluegrass Quartet. In fact, he felt that some people used to chide him for not going to church regularly, and he said, well, I feel I've fulfilled my obligation by singing these gospel songs at every show. So, you know, but he, you know, he listened to, I mean, he had, you know, fans in both the white and black community, and some of the black gospel people actually gave him songs to record.
And I, in speaking to a couple of the members of the great Clara Ward Singers, they told me when they would travel around the South, they would put on the radio, and they would listen to white gospel. That's why they recorded Gray Speckled Bird, for example, and some other songs.
Who was this? Which?
Clara Ward. Well, Clara Ward, actually, yeah. I was speaking to Marion Williams, who was the great lead singer. But so, yeah, the music was kind of integrated.
Yeah, in fact, Bill Monroe.
And now we have klezmer joining it.
Right, right. Well, it's you know, it's what I'm doing is very idiosyncratic to me. I wouldn't say it's, you know, if I play bluegrass, if I'm going to play straight ahead bluegrass, I'll play it differently than I would play in this context, more or less. You know, I should mention also that there was a wonderful harmonica player who that used to travel around with Bill Monroe and D. Ford Bailey.
Yes.
And he was the first regular black musician on the Grand Ole Opry going back into, I guess, the late 30s, early 40s. And Bill Monroe used to go around with the tent show. And he was part of that show, and Monroe would personally take him to a hotel, and he'd get him, you know, he treated him very well. And actually, they were pretty tight. So, you know, there's so much, you know, musicians, as they say, have big ears. I know when Bill Monroe had this very crucial band in the mid to late 40s, 1945, he used to play a lot of times down in New Orleans with his brother Charlie. They were one of the big country music brother duets, which was back, you know, big in the 30s. And when he had this band, they hung out in New Orleans for about, I don't know, a month and a half, going to different clubs, listening to music, because he wanted the musicians with him to understand the different styles of rhythm and grooves that was being played down there and how they would adapt it to what they were doing.
And you've played with Dr. John, so...
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us now?
I don't think we'll do some improvisation on an old standard fiddle tune. It's called Arkansas Traveler that I think was very popular on some cartoon back in the 40s. I don't know which one.
So we have Andy Statman on mandolin and Larry Eagle on dubek. And this is Let It Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Okay, let me make sure I'm going to move this around here. You know, I'm going to...
The headphone wire is getting in the way.
Can I take it off? Is that...
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
You don't need headphones to play?
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't need headphones to play, do you?
No, usually in the studio. I usually take off one ear anyway or sometimes.
By the way, we should point out that the your producer and record company owner started here at WBAI, Edward Haber.
Correct.
He was an audio engineer at WBAI when I arrived in 1977.
I first met Ed here when you were playing back at the church, and when you had that beautiful studio there. Not that this isn't beautiful as well.
Oh,
but
well,
it's just different.
The church was a lot more beautiful.
It's a different. And actually, Ed did the first demo for me, you know, which got me a record deal. So,
and now there've been You have 20 records under your own name, and
something like that, maybe more. I don't know.
Okay, Andy Satman and Larry Eagle.
So if I have this, can I hear?
Called?
That's Arkansas Travelers, just an improvisation over a simple,
That was Arkansas Traveler.
Yeah. So with this type of improvisation, what you do is you keep the...
So it's kind of jazz, in a way. You're not playing on chord changes, are you?
Well, I am playing on chord changes, but I'm also playing off... I'm playing off the melody. So, in other words, I know what the melody is, so I'm just playing with the melody in mind, just sort of letting it go freeform, and it can get pretty far out at times, But if I'm playing for dancers, I wouldn't play this way. If I was playing at a bluegrass concert, it would be a little bit of a different spirit. But this type of thing is very open. So it's just a different type of improvisation than, say, in jazz. But it's certainly informed, as they say, by jazz, but other things as well.
The mandolin has a very distinctive sound.
Yeah.
How different is it to play than a guitar? And why does it sound so different? Because the minute I hear it, I think, oh, we're going to the country.
Right. The guitar...
Could be a lot of countries.
Yeah. The guitar is, first of all, it's a... it has a greater range. I mean, in many ways, it's a superior instrument. And it has a greater range. It has a greater... here you have double strings. They're tuned high. So it's like A, like E, E, A, A, D, D, G, G, like a violin, but double. Mm. So there's an enormous amount of tension on the strings, which gives it its ping. And it's particularly these are American-style mandolins that were developed in the... teens and 20s. It's just, it's smaller and it's it just has a nice punch to it.
Well, you've played, a more modern, what is it, a Kimball FS mandolin, you played a 1920s Gibson A2Z for 35 years. Is it very different?
It's a bit of a different sound, but no, the I had just changed because I was having trouble with the with the neck on that. And these F5s, like a violin, has what's called a raised fingerboard. It's not attached directly to the top. It has. So
sounds great.
Yeah, it is. So these types of mandolin were developed by Gibson in the 1920s, and they, instead of having a bowl back, they have sort of like a violin, like a little bit of an arched back. And they have, instead of round holes, he gave them F-holes like the violin family. Hmm. So they produce a particular type of sound. And people like Bill Monroe went for a certain type of punch in the, a certain type of, mm-hmm. And so that's the American mandolin, basically.
Now, how many of the songs on the album did you compose?
Well, I wrote all of them. Actually,
specifically for the album?
Yeah, when I started this out, as you said before, I started going over different Bill Monroe instrumentals, which I thought would be fun to just improvise on, and I started writing my own melodies off them, or as extensions of them, and completely changing them so they were just something different. I forgot what the question was.
Well, you start off thinking you're going to do a Bill Monroe song,
right.
And you wound up composing all of them
for
the album.
Right. So we actually recorded a bunch more, which will come out on another record. But the albums are definitely reflective of elements of Bill Monroe, although they may not be readily apparent.
Well, one of the tracks, Reflections, has the same title as a Thelonious Monk classic. Are you thinking about Monk when you came up with that title?
Not really, no. I'm not a big title guy.
Uh-huh. And but you have said you're a big Monk fan.
I'm a big Monk fan, and I think of Monk often, fondly. But in terms of titles for tunes, I usually give tunes some sort of provisional title, as, ballad in G or something, And it's only at the last minute, when I have to actually come up with the name of a song, do I start, getting out the thesaurus or thinking about what the song, might mean. So,
Larry, is there any collaboration involved in this?
There was on the last record, I recall. But this one, again, we have a problem when we play these songs as a trio with Jim Whitney, our bass player. We keep referring to them by the provisional titles that we knew them by for the last 3 or 4 years while the record was in process, and we can never remember what the actual titles are.
The title that's on the
exactly.
CD
right.
package. Were you listening to Monk at the same time you were listening to Bill Monroe?
There was an overlap there, and then I...
Were your parents confused by this kid who was into bluegrass and jazz?
I was a pretty strong-headed, kid, and I was always very obsessed with whatever I was interested in, whether it be dinosaurs or, radio. I was captured by the romance of these things. So, they knew me, and at a certain point, as all parents know, you have to... you have to know when to apply the pressure and when not to, and when. So they were, I feel bad for, if my 15-year-old was going down to Virginia or going out to some bar in New Jersey, with college students, I wouldn't be pleased. So they were, The other thing, though, is that is I come from a musical family, so on a certain level, they had to realize that it was in the genes. But once I got my first, good review in the Times, it was around 1970, things really changed, and they saw maybe it's a viable income for me.
Well, my mother was a professional, a performer, singer.
Oh, yeah?
But she couldn't understand my love of jazz. She said, it sounds like doodle-oodle-oodle to me.
It's, my father, told me that he actually liked bluegrass after we were, fighting about me not going to school.
Were they surprised when the klezmer came along?
No, they liked that also. I mean, my parents had good taste in music, and you know, my father used to want, he used to want to be a lyricist, and he wrote some lyrics, and, you know, Sammy Fan was our cousin, so he, you know, hopefully, you know, thought maybe he could write some lyrics for some of Sammy's things. But there was always music going on in the family of all types. I mean, I remember when, you know, the first rock and roll started coming out, I was about, you know, 2, 3, but I remember hearing all, you know, all those things, and my brother was listening to these, you know, all this stuff, so... You know, I just grew up with everything, you know, from Mozart to Little Richard. I mean.
Well, I'm thrilled that the two of you are playing live here, and we're going to have another live performance. But we thought we'd play a track from the CD, Monroe Bus, as well, because you have a whole bunch of other musicians on the CD. What do you want us to play?
I think Ice Cream on the Moon. Probably, okay. Yeah. That's, I mean, each cut on this record is very, very different, although they all work together very beautifully. But they're all just different types of tunes, I guess, reflective of the different styles of music that I've played and that we've all played.
And this has Michael Cleveland, who's been named Fiddler of the Year for 10 years?
I think more than that. Yeah, Michael is one of the, you know, premier bluegrass fiddle players and one of the most amazing musicians around nowadays. And first I'd say it's myself and Larry and Jim Whitney, which is the trio. And we've been working together for close to 20 years. It's very rare you find a working band, particularly in New York City these days, that's been together for that long. And Michael's on this, and Glenn Pache, who's an incredible keyboardist. Incredible keyboardist.
Okay. Ice Cream on the Moon. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. Wow. That was called Ice Cream on the Moon. It is one of the tracks on Andy Statman's latest record called Monroe Bus, which is on
Sheffer
Records, produced by Edward Haber. And he also owns the company.
Yeah, yeah.
And who has a long history with WBAI and WMYC. How did you meet him and how did you come to collaborate?
I guess I met Ed at WBAI around 1987, maybe. I had been in Nashville. I'd been working with a great fiddle player named Vassar Clements. He was an incredible improviser and player and touring around in the bus. And I came back to New York and
The microphone
that.
Is your friend.
That's not my cough, yeah, yeah.
If you were a singer, it'd be different.
Yeah, I started writing, a lot of music and developing an approach to some of this more traditional music that was a bit more open. And I met Ed through when I was a few years earlier when I was playing with Bromberg. This was probably 1970, 71. And Ed, we'd play at BAI, and Ed would come down and...
He was the engineer there,
yeah, so he'd be recording it, and that's how I met him.
Now, that track, Ice Cream on the Moon, is kind of progressive rock and jazz fusion, and then it moves into bluegrass.
Yeah, well, there's...
That's all trying to keep your rhythm section on its toes.
There's, a lot, some of these songs have a certain sense of humor to them, for lack of a better word. Others try to go deep, but this particular song is it has its deep moments, but it also has a sense of humor to it.
Now, you began playing banjo and guitar when you were 12, then moved into the mandolin, also tried your hand at R&B and jazz saxophone,
yeah.
And you currently double on clarinet.
Yeah.
Now, does that require a totally different mindset?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, both instruments affect the other, in my understanding, but the clarinet or a wind instrument is a legato instrument, so I don't know if you use a tremolo to play. And
they say the clarinet is the most difficult of all the reed instruments to play.
Yeah, I mean...
Because it tends to go out of tune.
Yeah, there are tuning problems in theirs, but I mean they're all difficult to play if you want to get to a certain level with it, but you can also do lots of glisses and slurs and note bending and things with the clarinet that you can't really do on the mandolin.
So you usually use it when you're playing klezmer.
Yeah, well, klezmer or Hasidic music. Klezmer actually comes out of Hasidic music. It's sort of part and parcel of that, and. It all actually comes out of the what they call Nusach, is the Jewish prayer melodies that are not actual songs, but ways prayers are. They're not really chanted; they're sung in a certain way by a person who'd be leading the prayers.
Is there a significance in the fact that you play klezmer and the Orange County village of Monroe, New York, is very close to the Hasidic enclave, Kiryas Joel?
I've actually played up in Kiryas Joel, yes. I've played there a few times at weddings. But what do you say, Larry? We're getting into a little bit of a...
Monroe. When I first saw a Monroe bus, I thought, this is about taking the bus... Because I knew that you'd play a lot of klezmer.
Right.
They're taking the bus up to Monroe to Kiryas Joel. Well,
as Andy mentioned, there is a sense of humor to what we do. And there was a realization that, yes, there is a large observant community so close to New York in Monroe. So that was in our minds when we came up with this.
And there, it's a place, I don't know if there's a train there, but buses do go there. But
and you say that when you were a teenager, the Monroe bus was nicknamed Bluegrass Breakdown?
Yeah, it was actually called Bluegrass Special, but it broke down so much, so many times, that they called it the Bluegrass Breakdown.
That sounds like a great name for a song.
Oh, it is. It's the name of a famous Bill Monroe instrumental called Bluegrass Breakdown. You know, what had happened was I write in the liner notes, there was a particular type of feeling that Bill Monroe has in certain types of compositions, sort of a mid-tempo type of groove. So I decided we needed one song on the record like that, and Michael would be the ideal fiddler to play it. So I got home pretty late, and I spent the next few hours writing this song, and got it to where I liked it, and I went to sleep. And I had a dream in which Bill Monroe appeared to me. And we were out in the Texas prairie somewhere and by a campfire. And all of a sudden, Bill Monroe appeared there. Bill Monroe's a big, strong, strong man.
Dressed and wore 10-gallon hats.
Yeah. And he you know, he looked very trim. He looked like a Texas Ranger without the, you know, the star and the guns. And I saw him and I said, "Bill, what's wrong?" And he says, "You know, no one respects me. No one appreciates me." And I said, "Bill, I respect you." And he says, "I appreciate that." And that was the dream. So the next morning, I was taking a taxi to the studio, which is not far from here, you know, in Brooklyn. And as we're getting, you know, on the highway, I'm going over trying to remember the melody exactly to show the fiddle players from Michael Cleveland. And what do I see getting on the highway but a bus that's headed to Monroe? So I said, you know, this is it. This is the name for that song, and this is probably what I should call the record.
Ice Cream. Oh, a Monroe bus.
Yeah, Monroe bus, yeah.
Now, what I would love is actually to have you play another tune. Is that possible?
Sure. Let me take off my earphones here.
Okay.
I can't hear.
We have Andy Statman and Larry Eagle here, and they are about to perform live for us on mandolin and dumbek. I got it right this time?
Yeah, absolutely, perfect.
And what are you going to play?
We just played something sort of
That's
fair.
That's true, we did.
Thank you. Andy Statman and Larry Eagle. What was that called?
Just something
you just came up with?
It's sort of an approach or a theme that we usually improvise in and do. You know, I kept it short here.
Is it as much fun to play as it was to listen to? Because it really swung.
It's a gas. Part of the great thing about the mandolin is that in bluegrass and, I guess, other music, it's a wonderful rhythm instrument. In some ways, I rather play rhythm than solo.
And I assume that you never play it the same way twice.
No, never.
Yeah.
Were you sure where it was going to go, Larry?
I had no idea where it was going to go. We never do, and that's why we enjoy it.
Part of the fun.
Most of the fun.
Now, in your other life, we've talked a bit about klezmer. Don't you participate in a yearly klezmer concert series with Yitzhak Perlman and other klezmer superstars?
Yeah, it's sort of an ongoing project that this last year we did a few tours, and it's really great. He's a wonderful, wonderful person, a wonderful musician, and when we play, he actually does a bunch of tunes that I wrote, and we just improvise. We play the heads, and then we just improvise and trade eights or trade fours or trade twos, and it's a gas. He's absolutely incredible.
A classical violinist who can do this kind of thing as well.
Yeah, he's really very fluent in the traditional, you know, klezmer language, and you know, has a great understanding of it and plays with a lot of depth and feeling.
How old were you when you turned to klezmer music as part of the mix?
You know, I heard it growing up as a child, and
in Jackson Heights.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my grandfather had, you know, 78s, and I heard it there. And then there was a record on some of the old Mickey Katz records. There would always be some klezmer. And there was a record that came out called Music for Weddings, Brisses, and Bar Mitzvahs by Mickey Katz.
Isn't Mickey Katz Joel Gray's father?
Yeah, he is, yeah. So at family get-togethers, we used to dance to that music. I mean, my father, you know, his parents used to go to all those big, Laughmannschaffen balls, and they'd dance to this music. So.
And Mickey Katz also did a lot of comedy records.
Yeah, I think he was with Spike Jones for a while. Mm. Yeah. So I grew up hearing it, and I remember when I started getting into jazz, it was still very much under the influence of Coltrane and world music and spirituality, and a lot of the Albert Eiler's music that I love the best, where he'd play these almost Balkan or Salvation Army sounding melodies and then go off into, sounds and colors, rubato with, you know, the drums going wild. And so I thought that some of these klezmer tunes would be good for that. So I started experimenting with that around, you know, 68, 69. And I started working with Zev Feldman around 72, I guess. And we started playing a lot of Azerbaijani music and other music, but we got into the klezmer music. As far as we knew, no one was playing it back then, and I was able to find Dave Taras, who was one of the greatest instrumentalists to come over from Europe and study with him.
And he taught you how to play klezmer clarinet. Didn't he give you an instrument?
Yeah, I have a number of his instruments, and he would. You know, I wound up when I came back to New York from Nashville, I wound up living not far from where he lived, maybe a 20-minute walk. So I became almost like what they call a Ben Bias. I almost lived with him, and I'd go get his medicine for him and go with him to get a haircut or buy stuff. But he would always, I'd get there, we'd talk, we'd eat. He'd take out his clarinet and just play for me for 45 minutes or an hour and give me a little hand gestures or what to signal things, and I'd say, Dave, how did you do this? Or Dave, should you do this or not this? And that's what I learned.
Do you ever wonder what it's like to be one of those musicians who plays the exact same thing every night? I've always wondered whether you get bored after a while, but you have no choice because that's what the audience expects.
You know, I think it depends on. There are a few different ways. In general, I could never do it. I mean, even if I was playing with, you know, unless there was real freedom and variation. And I know in classical music, I think their interpretive liberties they take each night. The tempo might be slightly different. It's a different feeling. But they can't really improvise or really change a lot. You know, the musicians who work Broadway.
Or rock performers.
Yeah, there might be a little bit more leeway there. I don't know. But it's, you know, it's you make a good living, and it's a steady paycheck, and you get benefits if you have a family. And but I'm not sort of really cut out for that. I was never cut out for that. Hmm. Some people are.
Larry, you're shaking your head. You probably have never played the exact same thing two times in a row.
Not for lack of trying on occasion, but it doesn't always turn out the way you want it to. But yes, there have been times when I've played Broadway, off-Broadway, just occasionally, and it's a different discipline. It's a different way of approaching music.
Meanwhile, you are at the Park Slope Club Barbas on a regular basis?
Yeah, we're there monthly, yeah.
And that's not Klezmer. That's the other side?
No, you know, when
because that's kind of like a folk club.
No, they have a lot of jazz there, actually. What the trio has developed is a way of doing, we usually start out with the clarinet, and we do, that'll just be background for now. That's okay. That's my phone. So, I'm sorry.
When I was just a little boy?
Yeah. I set that up so you could sing. You tell him you used to sing, so. Anyway, that's pretty loud. Anyway, our performance, unless they ask otherwise, is we start out with clarinet music and we do either traditional sounding music that I wrote or, you know, classic music or klezmer. We do it with our own improvisational style, and then we move into this original music, more American sounding music.
And then you also play regularly with the trio at Derech Amuno's Synagogue in Greenwich Village?
Yeah, in Charles Street. Yeah, we're there, you know, during the, we're off for certain holiday breaks, but we're there pretty much every Thursday night.
December will be our 20th anniversary of playing there. That's our home base, our playground. We get to do whatever we want to do. Although I have to say that at most of our other shows, we pretty much do what we feel like doing anyway. But the Charles Street Synagogue.
Would you play the kind of thing you just played?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just duets with me and Larry, or me and Jim. And also we have a lot of you know, great musicians who come down and sit in, people coming in from different places. So.
Now, you joked earlier that there are no record stores anymore. But we still have the CD.
Right.
So where do people get the CD, and can they stream it on Spotify or on YouTube?
They can stream it, and I know Amazon has it.
And Apple Music has it. It's downloadable, like everything has to be these days. But the actual physical CD, if you still have a CD player, is available on Amazon. I can't recite the link because it would require some linguistic assistance, but you can search for Monroe Bus, Andy Statman, and certainly find it on Amazon.com.
And certainly at gigs, they're sold. So, as souvenirs at gigs that we play.
Well, I'm so pleased that you were able to come and talk and perform on our show.
Thank you for having us. It's really great.
It's been a great pleasure and a great honor. Andy Statman and Larry Eagle, and a reminder that their newest CD, their 20th or so under Andy Statman's name, is called Monroe Bus. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.